Welcome everybody to the Strength Academy podcast. Sorry for the technical difficulty, but this is Mundo, joined once again by Grayson.
How's it going, guys?
And so we have a special guest today for you. His name is Derek Hamilton. He is a professor of psychology at the University of New Mexico, and he's got some interesting takes on the world of weightlifting and some of his tricks for psychology. And we wanted to talk a little bit about maybe some crazy ideas that we've been discussing outside of sports, but still relevant to the conversation. So let's just get started by introducing our guest. Derek, did you want to say anything about yourself?
Thanks for having me. I've enjoyed working with you guys for the last year and a half. Been in New Mexico for about 23 years, originally from Tennessee, moved out here for grad school, eventually took a faculty position and psychology at the University of New Mexico, and been there for about the past 15-16 years, and just recently got into weightlifting as a 47-year-old.
Okay.
So relatively later in life, and so yeah, interested in talking with you guys about my experience and my thoughts about it, and you know, what the future holds.
Yeah, so what kind of brought you into like wanting to choose doing kind of, we've been doing pretty much powerlifting and a little bit of bodybuilding work. So like what kind of made you want to take this kind of more structured approach to kind of getting into it?
Yeah, I'd say there were multiple factors. So multiple sources of motivation. The first thing was I just mentioned that I'm from the Southeast, and typically when I go back home, I usually come back to New Mexico with some motivation to do something healthy. You know, I see a lot of my family and friends and things like that struggling with health-related issues, or as I get older, having issues with back problems or weight in general. So I grew up in a small community in East Tennessee, and kind of the typical diet and lifestyle does not lend itself well to, I think, aging well.
Okay.
So I was getting to the age where I'm sensitive to those sorts of things, and yeah, some trips back home sort of reminded me that I probably needed to up my game a little bit in terms of some of the things that I was doing. It wasn't that I was not active or really concerned about my weight, but just developing some habits and behaviors that I wanted to put in place for the remainder of my life to avoid some health related issues happening. So I didn't really come into it with great motivation towards I want to bench press 400 pounds and squat 1,000 pounds or anything
right,
like that.
Yeah,
it was
yeah.
mostly like, when I'm 90, can I get off of a toilet without help, or can I not get stuck in bed, or can
right.
I avoid back problems by not being out of shape and things like that. So yeah, that's one of the motivations. The structured part really is kind of something I've matured into as well. I'd say my attitude as a younger person in my 20s and 30s was that, well, I could figure out how to do anything, so why would I go looking for somebody to teach me how to do it? And I think as I got older, and you get used to talking with people like financial planners, and I play golf, so if anybody plays golf, I would recommend that you take lessons, because it's really difficult to figure out on your own what you're doing wrong. And I started to gain an appreciation for going to experts, just rather than trying to figure out things on my own. So I would go to the gym on my own and kind of dabble, and go to a crowded gym at UNM, for example,
right,
at 5 o'clock when everybody's in there working on a machine and trying to figure out some routine to do, and the exercises you do end up getting constrained by what other people are doing rather than what your plan was. And I was just, I think, never really disciplined about coming up with a plan, so I kind of wanted to add that piece. And then I wanted to address some issues that I had, from shoulder injuries I had when I was younger, maybe 10-12 years ago, and some flexibility issues, because I want to be able to do things like play golf and stand up normally when I'm retired. And so I started looking for places to work out, and that's how I found you guys.
Okay.
So yeah, what's been, I'd say that we've definitely kind of taken off on all of the big three. Kind of, we really started with working with lightweights in the bar and kind of have progressed up, but your deadlift has really taken off. Would you say that's kind of your favorite? Do you have a favorite of the things that you've been working on?
Well, that's the one that I've seen the most improvement in, because when I came, I literally never deadlifted before. So prior to coming here, really my weightlifting experience was limited to some like poorly trained weightlifting behaviors in high school from like high school football.
Yep.
You know, there's a 14-year-old turn you loose in a room. At least that was my experience. Like, not a lot of instruction, or poor instruction in some cases on, you know, how to properly do a squat. But I'd never deadlifted before, so I had lots of room for improvement there. And you know, that's reinforcing and fun to see. So I think when I came in, yeah, we literally just started on lightweight and technique, and yeah, definitely seen the most growth there. I think I was probably already a bit stronger on bench, and
yeah, that tends to be kind of like a natural point of even, you know, because you said you used to play judo.
Yeah,
I'm sure you did a ton of push-up work and that sort of stuff.
Yeah, you develop a pretty strong core doing that, you know, moving people around and things, but
manipulating external objects.
yeah.
So what's kind of you know, you said you were kind of looking to change some habits, but what sort of things about kind of the process that we've done has kind of, because the biggest problem that people have when they start a new exercise routine is burnout or getting bored of doing it. What's kind of kept you, like, what about this style of training has kept you interested?
Yeah, well, I'll preface, you know, my answer with saying that was my expectation for what would happen when I started doing this, is that I would get tired of it pretty quickly.
Right.
Because I know the way my mind works pretty well by this point in my life, and I know how easily I get bored with things. Okay. And so I don't personally think that I could do things like go running on a treadmill or things that tended to just be kind of, you know, monotonous and the same thing over and over again. And that was, in full admission to you guys now, my expectation when I started was that I would probably kind of get tired of it or burn out. And was surprised, you know, when I actually kind of got hooked on it. And I think, you know, from my background in psychology, you know, working on learning and behavioral modification, one of the things that works really well with the sort of linear progression approach that people go through and what I did with you guys is you're always seeing improvement. So the reinforcer for me became, well, the next time I go to the gym, I get to go up 5 pounds on everything.
You know, yeah.
And that sort of like incremental progression actually is really reinforcing.
Okay.
Whereas I think going in and doing exactly the same thing every time, you know, for starters, probably would have, you know, been less exciting to me.
Yeah.
Yeah, because I would imagine when most people start out, like they go to bodybuilding.com, pick whatever workout, you know, and then they do just like some back and buys, chest and tries, and then the rest of the week kind of falls off. They skip leg day and stuff like that. Yeah. So it's just like having a structure and something to fall back onto where it's already been laid out for you is real helpful. And then there's that incentive to keep going with the linear progression as well. So that keeps you engaged.
Yeah, yeah. I think, to put it into context, since we were talking about motivations, my motivations didn't include like looking better.
Sure.
So right. I wasn't coming at it from a perspective, it was like, I need to get really big muscles.
Right.
I just wanted to improve, you know, bone and muscle strength and become more flexible.
Yeah, it goes back to longevity for you. A lot of people do have that aesthetic goal, and that's okay. But like, for weightlifters and people that do strength training in general, I mean, the whole idea is right there in the word strength training. So yeah. Like we want to be strong, and sometimes it's at the cost of being aesthetic.
Yeah.
But it just depends on what your goal is, and for you, I guess it was less aesthetic and more strength based then.
Right. Right. And so because of the way I was thinking about, you know, how I had no idea, you know, what about anything about Olympic weightlifting,
sure,
or really powerlifting, you know, for that matter. I was pretty naive to all that when I came in. So for me, like I said, the source of reinforcement mainly seemed to be from, okay, I do the work and I get to go up.
Right.
And I want to be able to do more. So every time I go, I get to do more.
Yeah.
And so it's a long time on a progression like that when you start low before you ever get to a point where you fail. I mean, I think I started in April mm-hmm. of 2018, and it was, I mean, I remember the day that I first failed on something.
Right.
And it was like in August. So it took 6 months, roughly.
Yeah.
Okay.
To get to a point where you weren't,
you stalled on progress.
Some reinforcement. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Which is really important for establishing a behavioral pattern.
And that's one of the main reasons that whether it's, you know, working on general strength training and powerlifting or doing the Olympic lifts, I always include some sort of a linear progression in those beginner programs. Because especially if you're trying to learn how to snatch on top of something, that's not going to feel good for a while. So like
yeah.
putting in a few exercises here and there that kind of has that reinforcing effect. One of the cool things that I thought though is that after about, you know, a year of, we were just focusing on, let's see if we can go up in weight. We'll try a few different programs. As we start to get more adept at the basics, we'll start branching out in exercises. But it kind of brought up, you know, you kind of self-selected to kind of start doing some diet work over the last few months. So do you think that kind of grew out of some of the weight stuff, or do you just feel like you were solid enough on your habitual training to kind of add another element? Because you didn't try to do it all at once, which mm-hmm. I think is a really good idea for yeah. most people.
Yeah. Yeah. I think there were a few things going on there. So when I first came, the main activity that I did was that I would play golf a couple of times a week. So I walked the golf course carrying a bag two times a week. And when I started doing this, I had the appetite of like a 14-year-old boy for like maybe the first 8 or 9 months.
Yeah.
I mean, I literally could not eat enough food. Anytime I saw food, I wanted to eat more, and I like to eat.
Yeah.
So those two things combined together led to the strategy of eat anything that you see for a while. And I rationalized that to myself that, well, I'm putting my body through something like very different than anything
sure.
that I've done before. And I rationalized it as a recovery aid.
You're like, there's a new stimulus. This is the adaptation that's taking place right now.
Exactly.
And that's not entirely wrong.
Yeah. Well, you know, one peanut butter sandwich is good. Two would be twice as good.
Two is twice as good, yeah.
You see where that mathematically can
exponentially
go.
It just gets better and better.
And so it was probably a good 8 or 9 months before I got to the point where I just like, wasn't hungry all the time. I didn't keep notes on it, but I'm
sure.
pretty sure it was near the beginning of 2019 when I was finally like, okay, you don't need to eat everything that gets within 6 feet of you. And then I started thinking more about cutting back on some calories, but I really didn't do it in a systematic way. Mm-hmm. Again, it was sort of, you know, that mindset of thinking, well, it's like eating, everybody eats, I know how to eat, so I will just dial back on the calories. And actually what happened is I was eating too little.
Okay.
And suffering the consequences of that for a while. So I was thinking back to, like, I think in March of this year, right. So maybe and 5-6 months ago, we maxed and I went out to Buca de Beppo.
I'm
going to have, like, a big family-sized serving of spaghetti like the day before this. And I felt so awesome the next morning.
Yeah, I remember that. You were like, I ate like 3 pounds of spaghetti. We're ready to go. So I think that you kind of fell into a trap that one of the, you know, popular things lately is kind of talking about intermittent fasting. And I think you kind of hit a wall with that because, you know, intermittent fasting is a great way to kind of limit your calories throughout the day. But I'm not really sure if, like, I like that approach for lifters because it seems like you just end up pretty tired.
Yeah.
I'm glad you mentioned it because until you said it, I had amnesia for it. I went through probably this spring up to early part of summer, like through June, I would say, doing kind of like warrior diet. Like, get all your calories, like, one meal during the day, maybe, like, a small meal later, and then that was it. And that did not work for me. I actually put on about 8-9 pounds.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Doing that. But I wasn't paying all that much. But, you know, the caveat would be I wasn't closely monitoring my caloric intake. I was like, well, I'm eating one meal.
How much can you
get in? I mean, there's only so much you can fit in your body, and it can't be 4,000 calories, so I'm good. That was, you know, so it was a lazy attitude on my part. So I think sort of the same thing with, you know, coming to you guys and systematizing things for the workout is, you know, having some sort of, you know, systematic approach to eating. And finding like an external source for that, since I know that I can't be trusted to do it on my own.
Right.
So you've been using the RP app. You just finished up. Is it like a 10-week cut? Using their kind of
60 days. Yeah,
that's a pretty good amount of time. So what were the results that you ended up getting from using the app?
Well. Overall, I cut 14 pounds in 60 days. Felt really good and, bought all in when I saw how things were structured for it. In terms of, you know, basically I approached it like a, you know, if it fits in your macros approach. There are just a number of things in there that seemed counterintuitive to me. And I was like, well, I'll try them and see if they work. So, eating your biggest meal right before you go to sleep.
Oh, yeah. That's the best part about how they structure it, though.
Well,
yeah.
Do you think they developed that on purpose? Like, is there a psychological advantage to having that kind of setup? Or is it just something that they're like, oh, well, athletes will probably use this, and then they geared it toward those types of people?
Yeah, I don't really know much about, you know, the background that went into it. I mean, sure. I know that they've blogged and written a lot about, like, what's gone into the app, but I literally, from my perspective, just approached it like this is a behavior management tool,
right?
And it's going to tell me how much of, you know, what macros to eat and when, and I'm just going to do that. And so if it said eat 60 grams of protein and 25 grams of fat and 60 grams of carbs,
sure,
45 minutes before you go to sleep, I'm going to do it. And I just stuck to it, I think, pretty well cohered to the, you know, good coherence with the plan, and, you know, it worked well for me. I just got to the point where I kind of had, you know, low energy, and I did make some mistakes on it.
Okay.
Like telling it, you know, my body type was probably a little on the less lean side than it is, and probably underestimating some of the activity levels, you know, that I gave it,
sure,
that it was working with. So for anybody who's using it, I would recommend being truthful with it. As I tend to be a little bit more conservative on those things and think I'll just deal with it and figure it out. But
yeah, once you hit that kind of zappy energy wall at the end of a cut, it's kind of hard.
I had a couple of days where I was like, okay, that's it.
And I think that's where people most struggle with the app, is like the most questions that I got when I was helping people set things up is that, like, where do I fit in body type wise and like activity level wise, because they don't know how to gauge the level of intensity that weightlifting entails. And so while we work out for 3 to 4 hours a day potentially, that doesn't mean we're active the entire time, the entire 4 hours. It's more like bursts of energy are spent. And then when you get to the portion of like behavior management with diets and things like that, that's all it is, right? It's just behavior management. You're just controlling what you put in your mouth at any given time and point during the day.
Yeah, that's the main part that I focused on. There's plenty of aspects of my life where I want like complete control over what's going on with it, and I'm okay to turn it over to other sources of control for other things.
Sure.
And so, I think feeding, which is how I'll refer to it, feeding, is like one of those things that I was very reticent to allow external control of.
Sure.
So this was an experiment for me. And I think we're gonna probably talk a lot about behavior management, since that's one of the areas that I kind of work in.
Okay.
But there's always ways to refine what you're doing.
Sure.
So this first cut I did with RP, I knew I wasn't going to eat the things that are on the RP app. All I needed to do was scroll through them and go, okay, this is pretty unrealistic for my lifestyle.
Sure.
I mean, I'm not going to have time to prepare 5 meals of all of this, great healthy food. I'm often in situations where I got to grab something quick, and that'll be a refinement I go after later. So I didn't try to do it all at one time. I just wanted to get, can I get the behavior part? Just like eat these macros now.
Sure.
And that was my only goal. I think if I had tried to do the whole thing, I would have been much more likely to fail at it.
Yeah. So it's kind of like a little bit about managing expectations, but also like knowing yourself well enough to say, I'm only going to probably comply with this at this rate.
Right.
And then just going off of that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I actually thought I'd probably only last like 30 days.
Okay.
So that I went 60 is probably due to the fact that I didn't go, okay, you're going to eat nothing but,
chicken and rice.
Chicken and broccoli.
And rice and, freshly prepared vegetables.
Yeah. Which is hard to do as an adult. It's hard to sit there for 3 hours and prep food. And take that time out of your day, especially if you have a bunch of other things going on. So when you look at your level of progress, not just with diet, but overall in weightlifting and things like that, what would you say you've gotten the most out of the experience? Weightlifting experience.
I would say that a lot of it has to do with the discipline of just coming and doing it. Right. There's something about having a stable base of behaviors that you do that are good for you,
right?
And it can, some days it can suck to go do them, but if you do them anyway, even if you don't achieve what you wanted to achieve, I think there's a stability that comes with doing it. So rather than just sitting around and wondering about, well, I only made it to the gym once this week, maybe I'll just go in, I'll throw up some bro lifts and then go home, and that would be better than nothing, and that would be true, but that's, to me, personally, that's not satisfying.
Sure.
I like the sort of incremental, building on what you've done before.
Sure.
And getting better.
Yeah.
And so for me, I think it's more of a sort of mental, thing, even though the goals are really physical.
Right.
That sort of mental side of it, of I've kind of got a thing that I go do, and I do it routinely, and you know it's good for me, and I see you know a lot of benefits from it.
Right.
Aside from that, I mean, I'm definitely tons stronger than I was a year and a half ago.
Yeah. I remember we had a conversation about like how high you can deadlift. Yeah. do you want to tell that story? Because like it's ridiculous that people that don't know what weightlifting is or powerlifting, like they have these notions that you're doing something that's extraordinary. But they don't know the levels of the extraordinariness that they're attributing to you. So, yeah, if you want to talk about that.
You had posted on Facebook, I think. You had posted like a video of me doing like a doubles deadlift. Right. I don't even remember the weight. It was like 420 or something.
Yeah, I think it was pretty close to that, yeah.
So this is like a couple of doubles at 420 pounds. And, yeah, one of my coworkers saw it and told me that it looked really good, looked really strong.
Yeah.
And then she asked if my goal was to go higher. And I was like, yeah. I mean, it's like, I'd like to get up above like 500 here soon. And she's like, no, I meant like higher on your body. Like, you know, just to get to the belly button.
Right. Next. Yeah. So like that's a classic example of people just not understanding like what the sport entails. And so, like, the idea was that you would try to lift the weight higher above your, like, your lockout with your arms straight in the deadlift. So
start bending the arms.
Yeah,
to get
start,
steady.
You start rowing it.
So do you think that, you know, I guess we can kind of start getting into some of the behavior stuff, but do you think that, like, part of what, like, you used the phrase, like, you got kind of hooked on the process and mm-hmm. hooked on training, and that's kind of a, like, it really does kind of become an addiction for people, and it can get to an unhealthy point where people are, like, staying up late watching YouTube videos and obsessing over things. But do you think that, like, part of why it's addicting is that there's some sort of, like, unmet challenge in the way that most of us live, where, like, we're kind of wired to have physical, like, tasks to accomplish, well, and like that's kind of satisfying on that end?
Yeah, it's to quote a famous psychologist, B.F. Skinner, sometimes it's just nice to control your world.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, that's reinforcing. I don't think Skinner said nice. I think he
probably
said, said reinforcing.
Yeah.
It's reinforcing to control the environment that you live in. And I mean, that's part of it, you know, is that you go do something, and if you think about it, this is like one of the few situations actually where you're in complete control of everything that happens, right? The
yeah.
external factors are really limited,
right?
So it's not like someone's going to come up and like kick you in the back of the leg while you're doing a lift
or the wind's going to knock you off balance.
You know, it's going to be down to you, and I think that sort of like individual. Or, you know, I mean, even if you just compare it to something like judo or martial arts in general,
sure.
I mean, you always have an opponent, and you know, this is kind of one of those things. Yeah, it's like a golf course. It's like, you know, well, the opponent is your weight or
right.
you know, the golf course.
Right.
But really, it's pretty much all comes down to you. And I think there's something that can be both crushing about that, but also very rewarding and uplifting about it. I don't know what to say about, you know, the issue of addiction to it. I think, yeah, you can get sort of like hooked up, particularly if you're very successful at it. For me, this is just part of my diversification of my, you know, behavior.
Sure.
It's one of like many things that I do.
Yeah.
And, you know, so for me, I'm probably less likely to become addicted to it because it's just, it fits, you know, a particular niche
set
for
of
me
needs.
And then I have lots of other things that I do
yeah
too.
So
that.
That reminds me of a quote that Greg Everett said a while back. It's like, you are the environment, and that's particularly true with weightlifting. Is just like a lot of the time our own mental perceptions of what's going on with the barbell and with ourselves have an effect on how well we perform. So do you think that you have more control over yourself now that you've been weightlifting for a while, or do you think that's just like something that you were already kind of good at and then it just carried over into weightlifting?
Yeah, I mean, I think I already had you know, some skills in that general area. I mean, completing graduate degrees and things like that kind of either select for and or, you know, force you into developing, you know, some pretty disciplined behavior.
Right,
I mean,
sure.
to you know, to be able to get yourself in the right mindset to be able to do the work and not just, you know, succumb to anxiety or things like that. What I think is added for me is there's a point when you're lifting something where you're like, I don't know if this is going to happen.
That's what I was going to ask you. Has there ever been a point or a weight that you've been afraid of? And if there was, maybe not necessarily fear, but maybe apprehension or hesitancy. And then, like, how did you overcome that? Or what did you do to work through it?
Yeah. So I experience that, like, pretty routinely now because I'm getting, to upper limits on weight. And, you know, I was explaining to someone the other day, like, you know, there's something about, you know, like, this could crush me.
Right.
You know, like, I could get. it's the roller coaster aspect.
Yeah.
It's like this could be really bad.
Sure.
And you know, if you overcome it, then that's powerful.
Yeah, that's satisfying.
If you fail, it can be frustrating.
Sure.
And the interplay of those two things, I think, is important for figuring out mentally where you are. I think for me, it's like I don't know a great deal about the literature on visualization,
sure.
But I do a lot of visualization, so I'm not coming at it so much from a scientific perspective as much as I'm kind of thinking about like what works for me.
Personal experience, yeah.
Yeah, sure. And I think what works for me is just sort of visualizing being done with it.
Yeah.
You know, rather than visualizing the part that sucks.
Right. Yeah.
You know,
being... That's a good point.
You know... A third of the way up on a squat.
Struggling.
And let me think about and visualize how difficult that's going to be.
Right.
And you just kind of think about, you know, clearing your mind and just thinking about what it's going to be like when it's over with. So I'm not even devoting any resources to the actual process of, like, what I'm going to do. I'll, you know, the mechanical stuff should all get kind of ingrained by just doing lots of repetitions of it. And then when you're doing something heavy, I think, The main thing is, right, don't introduce something mechanical that doesn't belong just because the weight's heavier.
Right, exactly. Yeah.
And so, yeah, being able to kind of think about it is like, well, it's not any different than any other weight. So getting out of your neocortex.
Sure.
Just getting into, okay, I have to
performing the action. Just performing the action. Yeah.
So we've chatted about visualization a bunch of times, just kind of casually. But you kind of mentioned that there's steps that can be useful to like kind of integrating some visualization practice. So maybe like if you're trying to like start out visualizing, and a lot of people just when they try it the first time, it doesn't work too well, especially when you're like trying to get to. What does it smell like? What is the lighting? Like all of these kind of little details. So like where did you start or where do you recommend people kind of try to sharpen some of that?
It's a tough question, and in part it's because it's conditional. There's a lot of variation in people in terms of how well they can visualize and like what domains they can visualize. So some people are going to be really good at just thinking about what their body is going to feel like. Other people are going to be good at sort of more literal, like visual sort of experience.
Like a third person perspective.
Or even first, like what you physically, you know, what are things going to look like in the world, you know, under certain circumstances. And there's variation there, so some people may not be very good at doing that. I think, I spent some time reading about like various strategies on how to get started, and it seems like a lot of the advice that you see online. I won't name anyone in particular, but it sort of presumes that you can just do this,
right?
And I don't necessarily think that that's the case or is necessarily useful if you can't do it. So the getting started part of it is like knowing what you're capable of doing. You know, if you know that you just are not going to be good at coming up with a mental image or something that, you know, matches, for example, what you're going to see or what your body is going to feel like.
Right.
You know, there may be, you know, another approach to it.
Well, do you think that comes from maybe like learning styles and aptitudes? Because like some people are more spatially aware than others. They have better like cognitive awareness of like the proximity of the barbell to their body, or even just in general. Like if you look at a piece of art, sometimes people will notice more fine details about the way the brush strokes are laid out or things like that. So like maybe their aptitude to visually imagine something isn't as good as somebody else's, so they need to start somewhere else, or maybe their ability to do that lies within another aspect of it.
Yeah, so there could be limitations that are, you know, directly related to what your sensory processes are like. I mean, if you think about it, your brain's probably not going to be able to create a sort of, you know, non-experiential representation of, you know, in some sensory modality if you're not already able to sort of sense things in that modality.
Right.
So if you don't have a great tactile sense, you know, I don't think you're going to be able to trick your brain necessarily into creating something that you wouldn't experience anyway. So for like me, I know that for like certain like things like auditory, like music, I'm going to be pretty good at picking out details and recognizing them. But when we get to colors, like not so much.
Okay. You know,
everything's blue or
it all the same shade of brown.
Yeah. And so there's something to that. I'm not saying you can't modify it.
Sure.
You might have to go through a lot of training.
Yeah.
So, you know, if you want to become better visual imagery, you might start working on just basic visual discriminations and learning how to distinguish things that maybe aren't so easy for you to distinguish.
Sure. Well, it's like learning to draw, right? Like everybody has the ability to draw. It's just that over time, we say that we lose the ability, you know, because we don't practice. And so some people are more kinesthetic. They're more, you know, some people are more auditory or visual. So like those different presentations, like especially for Grayson and I as coaches, not everybody's on the same like playing field as far as how they learn. So sometimes you need to give them more visual cues, sometimes you need to give them more auditory cues, and they'll perceive things or tactile, even changing their positions physically. So like that all takes, it all comes into play as far as like how people learn and adopt those types of things. And strategies like visual imagery and visualization, those things are all part of that. And so do you use something in particular to help you like visualize something?
Yeah, mine are almost all physical.
Okay.
You know, not visual. So the like visualization part is kind of a misnomer.
Sure.
It's not that I'm, you know, thinking about what things will look like when I've lifted the weight. I literally think about, you know, what my body's going to feel like.
Okay.
You know, at the end of it. I mean, and I try to limit it to like the fewest number of thoughts that I can have.
Sure.
I don't want it to be complicated.
Right.
But I think feedback plays an important role. And to get back to Grayson's question about like how you would you start, and I think you would have to identify what sort of strategy you want to use and then start to get some feedback in that domain. So if you're a person who, you know, the bar is foot away from you and you can't detect it,
right,
you know, it needs to be, you know, right up against your body and you're not sensing that, you know, you got to start doing some work, I think, on feedback within that domain and then, you know, correcting to that. You know, a lot of the things I think about when I first started doing this was I would literally, like, before I grabbed the bar, think, I'm getting ready to send a motor program. This is going to sound really nerdy, but
okay, go for it. Go for it.
This is the stuff I study.
So yeah, yeah.
I would literally think about, I'm going to send a motor program to grab the bar, and I would be thinking, this is what it's going to feel like when I grab it.
Okay.
And I did lots of that when I first came, and I did lots of that when I first started playing golf too. Just trying to come up with sort of models of the world. This is what it's going to feel like when you execute this behavior.
Right.
And then it becomes easier and easier and easier to sort of get in that mindset and say, okay, I'm in this situation now, and the weight is something I've never done before.
Right.
But I've done a lot of practice of thinking about what's it going to be like when I'm accelerating up in the squat and, you know, locking it out and finalizing it.
So you're kind of you kind of touched on something else that I thought would be good to talk about, where you're saying that, you know, you're kind of conceptualizing things from the physiology. So you're thinking about, all right, I'm sending nerve impulses to mm-hmm. these muscles, and then that's causing this contraction. And you said something like, I think it was last week, that, you know, I asked you if you thought something was a physical reaction or a psychological reaction. You said, well, all psychological reactions are physical reactions. And I was like, oh, well, so do you feel like that kind of, like, conceptualizing yourself as, you know, like, trying to think about your physiology rather than your, you know, like, your inner self, you know? Do you find that kind of a helpful way of, like, looking at behavior change? And is that a pretty good, like... non-dualistic framework to kind of
examine. Yeah, I do. I welcome the hate mail from any dualists who are listening. It's a meat machine.
Meat machine.
It does. I don't know. It works for me to think about things like that. At least, as an experimental psychologist, I don't know how to think about psychological processes outside of the context of the nervous system within which they arise and the body within which they arise, right? I mean, to me, the sort of psychological processes that we talk about, you know, that we're consciously aware of mm-hmm. and that are such a huge part of our moment-to-moment experience as humans is physiological. So in the classic materialistic sense, and I realize there's lots of, you know, arguments to be made against that.
Right.
But at the end of the day, I'm, you know, a flaming utilitarian, which is, me, it works to think about things like that. And it may not work for everybody. They may prefer to focus on, this is what my soul is saying should be happening.
Right.
I prefer to think of it as, you know, everything's mechanical.
So in that vein, like, so when you're thinking about changing a habit, or if it's, you know, trying to be more consistent, making it to the gym or adopting a new dietary strategy, like, how does that, what is the physiology of behavior? Like a real, I guess we're not going to deep dive, but just kind of like, what's happening when you modify a behavior or you learn a new skill? Like, what's the, physiology that's kind of underwriting that experience?
Well, I mean, as a science, we don't understand all of it. You know, we've got lots of, you know, good ideas, hypotheses about, what goes on with brain plasticity, and that's the area that I focus on. So partially, like, my motivation for doing behaviors and trying to be disciplined about it is I know that it's modifying the brain, right? It's modifying connections between neurons in the brain, increasing numbers of connections, maybe decreasing them when you're getting highly specialized skills, right? So you might have stronger connections that are, you know, more devoted or focused to a particular behavior. And so when I think about the sort of things that we're doing here, or more generally, like, anything that you do systematically, whether that's adaptive or maladaptive, right, that's going to be modifying your brain. I mean, the job of the brain basically is to take in sensory information and produce behavior, and to figure out how to get from A to B, figuring out how to get from sensory processes to behavior, for example. It's a major goal for the brain. And there's, in a human nervous system, human brain, lots of complicated ways to do that. So,
is that where the idea of the path of least resistance comes into play? Because the brain wants to shorten the time it takes to get from point A to point B? Or as you if you experience the same activity over and over again, then you get more efficient at it. So does your brain adopt mechanisms to shorten that process or automate that process?
That's the basic idea, right? Okay. Is that if you're doing the same sorts of behaviors over and over and over again, you move out of sort of a cognitive stage, right? You move out of having to consciously think about it and plan everything to just the behavior occurs.
Okay.
So the example I use in my classes a lot is there will be times you find yourself standing in front of the refrigerator with the door open, saying, I had no immediate plan to be here.
Right. Yeah. Right. Yeah.
But the door is open, and you know, whenever your significant other or roommate might say, you know, you're cooling off the whole house.
Yeah.
And you've got no plan. You had no reason for being there, but you did have a behavior that was, you know, ultimately elicited by, you know, the stimulus,
sure,
the refrigerator. In other cases, it could, like,
why
be completely.
Why did I go in this room again?
Cognitive control, right? Okay. That you made a plan. You went to get some food, and you're doing the exact same behavior, but it's the difference between cognitively being in control of the behavior versus it just being revealed by or released by the environment.
Habitual, like.
Well, and is that this is something that I've heard of, but like, is that kind of like default mode network? Is that sort of what this is supposed to be, where it's like, what are your kind of default thought patterns and like behavior patterns?
Yeah, default mode is, you know, the idea that there's a network in the brain that is sort of active when we're not doing anything that's task related. And if you switch into doing like task related activity, so a lot of the default mode networks is like determined at like rest, like when you're not really doing anything.
Okay.
Right. And so one way that you might think about it is if we didn't have a frontal cortex plan motor behaviors with, your behavior would just be released by environmental cues. So, you know, rather than having an internal sort of model of the world, your behavior would just be controlled by external,
like,
stimuli.
Reactions, yeah, then, as opposed to responses.
Yeah.
Okay.
So this is where you would see maybe irrational behaviors,
right,
you know, included too. So things that seemed like, you know, should be inhibited but aren't,
right,
any longer. So okay, the idea that there's like a trajectory towards habit, like you don't just establish a habit like quickly. Habit is a strategy that the nervous system uses to limit the amount of resources that you utilize to do the behavior.
Sure.
Right. So
right,
if you get food at the same source, like, you know, by approaching the same cues all the time to get it, eventually you'll quit thinking, oh, you know, there's the Carl's Jr. sign, I, you know, need to move towards that.
Sure.
It can just happen.
You just go.
So that idea of automatizing behavior, I mean, you see it in like driving all the time.
Yeah, driving.
So it's like unusual for me to come here today and I almost drove to work.
Right? Oh.
Because that's like the more typical thing,
right,
that I would be doing.
Yeah.
So.
That makes sense.
So overcoming some of that stuff, I know we've kind of talked about like little bits and pieces about like cognitive behavioral therapy or... but like if people are kind of looking to make, you know, small changes, whether it's, you know, in your, how hard you are on yourself,
mm-hmm,
or, you know, like what sort of like tricks or tips are, like, how do you stop being your own worst enemy? Like how do you get, you know, your thoughts on your side of things, really?
Yeah. Well, so you have to start at the cognitive stage, right? So, I mean, you can't jump to just wholesale change to like a new habitual behavior right away. So you will have to do behaviors, right, that are incompatible with the offending behavior or thing that you don't want to do, and do it enough to where that becomes your new way of thinking. So if it's you're hard on yourself, you might need to start with like a very sort of conscious cognitive plan, right, to say, you know, I'm not going to do that anymore, and then break it down into, I'm answering this like I'm a clinician or
yeah,
something. Everyone needs to know I'm not a clinician. they should not listen to what I'm saying unless they think it will be useful for them, and do so at their own risk. Do we need any other disclaimers?
No, I think that's...
Yeah. No.
We're not doctors.
Yeah.
This is just
so,
like, information.
If it were me, the way I would think, so if I were engaged in that sort of behavior, Like I beat myself up a lot. Like, here's everything I do, I'm like the Chris Farley character. Right? So, that's so stupid.
Yeah. Okay.
Is maybe saying, you know, like, okay, I understand at one level, right, that's not good for me, right? Because you probably got enough people already who will do that sort of stuff to you. You don't need to do it to yourself. You have to have like a framework and a why, like a reason that you want it to be different. And then I would say, okay, well, like, what behavior am I going to do?
Right.
So it's like, maybe when I do something that's stupid, instead of saying, that's stupid and I'm an idiot, I'm going to say, you know, yeah, no, it was a mistake, you know. But I'm okay with it, and I just won't, you know, try not to do it again.
Right.
And yeah. Just that alone is, like, sounds really simple, but is huge, right?
So yeah.
It's not as easy to do as it sounds to say it.
Right. It takes some effort.
So it might be saying, okay, so there's a theme emerging here. Keep it simple. It's like, what, one thing, like, this is what I'm going to say to myself instead of saying, that was stupid and I'm dumb. Right, because then that just, if you've got a habit developed of doing that, you're gonna have to consciously do something else.
Okay.
And my other piece of advice would be, forget how you feel about it, right, and just do the behavior.
Just do what you want.
The behavior that gets ingrained,
right.
So, and like, your reactions are based off. So it's not like thoughts eliciting behavior, it's behavior eliciting thoughts.
Well, so it's a cognitive behavioral therapy approach, right? Is the thoughts going to elicit the behavior? And so what I'm saying is not a cognitive behavioral approach, it's a behavioral approach, right? To say, I'm going to do this regardless of how internally I feel about it, what my emotional state is.
Well, and is that the idea? I know that I think that I heard that this was kind of not the best study and hasn't been replicated, but like the idea of like power posture, where like if you wanna do really well on a job interview, just like go stand in the bathroom for 10 minutes with your chest out and like stand up really straight and you'll be more confident.
You'll feel more confident.
If you adapt a confident posture.
Yeah. Well, you may, I mean, I don't know. I'm not suggesting like if, I'm not a big fan of like the fake it till you make it.
Yeah, right,
like
right.
Part of it. But yeah, it might be the difference between saying, okay, well, I'm not going to mope around, even though that's what I feel like doing. But like, yeah, maybe I'm not going to puff my chest out. I'm just going to try to act like a normal human being. Like, I shouldn't say normal. It's not like being depressed or something. Like, it's abnormal. It's
if a anything, it's standard,
thing.
Yeah.
That's just what I mean is, like, I'm not going to exaggerate it by going in the opposite direction,
right,
and say, now I'm going to be super happy all the time.
So, yeah, because that's...
No, I just want to behave in a way that doesn't yield this sort of very unpleasant sort of state.
Right.
Right. And so what I mean is behaving in a way that you say you want to behave even though you don't feel like doing it.
Okay.
Even if it feels bad to do it.
Yeah. So reinforcing the behavior that you want to continue by selectively choosing to do it, as opposed to saying, like, avoiding a bad feeling. So, like, not going to the gym because you just don't feel like it.
Right.
You show up anyway, yeah, even though you don't.
And do it and try to develop the habit of doesn't really matter how mentally I
right.
feel about doing this right now. It's still going to happen. Because what's worse, going and working out while you feel depressed or anxious, or
right.
not going and working out when
and
you feel
still
and feeling
and
that
anxious,
way anyway,
and
right.
still feeling depressed and anxious,
yeah.
and maybe feeling and
guilty or
not having the you know, the physical benefits. I always feel better when I leave here too, you know, I mean, just mentally feel better when I'm done. So yeah, it's that kind of, you know, can you not be fused with the emotional sort of psychological state that you're in and just do the behavior that you want to do.
Okay.
Despite
so,
that.
So you kind of have to be detached from specific ways of feeling.
Yeah. I think detached is probably a good word. I would say, like, don't ignore it and
right.
not, like, try to suppress it, but
right.
try to behave despite
and,
having
okay.
you know, an unpleasant psychological state.
Sure.
Yeah,
we got time for one more question.
Oh man.
Yeah, we're already cutting it.
Oh, we are. Oh man. Well, we'll definitely have to do a part two. But yeah, I think you know, to kind of wrap up on something more on the kind of fun part two side, like, when we were kind of talking about earlier you kind of mentioned whether you were arguing with people about worm consciousness, but you know,
worm consciousness.
I mean, but you know, so thinking about, you know, we were talking about, you know, self-talk, and you know, the weird thing is that, you know, it, you don't intentionally generate any of your thoughts. They just kind of arrive, and then you have to deal with them being around. So, like, is there anything that, you know, like, who's doing the talking? Where does, like, the thought generation kind of come from? Yeah. Like, at what levels, like, do you think that kind of... This is all pure
I've thought about this before, point. Too. It's like, where do thoughts come from? Like, because we don't seem to generate them all on our own all the time.
Yeah, so we were talking about creepy stuff earlier, too. And right. So, yeah, thoughts can... When I won't pretend to have an answer for your question.
Yeah, questions without answers is not part of it.
Yeah, this is definitely...
Not that I'm, you know, interested in dodging it. I mean, it's a fascinating question. Like, where does it come from? Some people would say it just comes from it comes from your history, right, of experience. And it's just, you know, it's ego, and it's there, selected for evolutionarily to, you know, keep you alive and make sure that you're successful at passing your genes on and all that. And then your subjective experience of it is just like one of the unfortunate byproducts of having that, okay, that particular strategy, right? So it's but the creepy part I was going to get to is, you know, some behavioral studies suggest that you're actually behaving before, you know, you're actually, you know, thinking about doing the behavior, maybe your thinking is just a way for you to rationalize your world and keep you from going nuts, even though you're not really in control of it.
Well, and that's you know, behavior. Something that I've found difficult to find a good argument against, because, you know, if everything is cause and effect and your behaviors are based on things that have happened to you in the past, and, you know, how much control do you really have over, you know, nobody plans the next word coming out of their mouth. You don't plan the whole sentence. You just start talking.
Right. Yeah.
And, you know, thinking about it, it's like, oh, man, how much control is an illusion in that situation?
I used to do a lot of that when I was younger. I start talking and
things be like, what am I saying?
Like, now where to take this? Yeah. You know, I have a little bit, I mean, maybe it's a different take that just relates back to my sort of general approach, the meat machine approach,
sure,
which is, I think evolutionarily, if you trace back where thinking, I mean, our conscious experience of thinking, I actually think, quote, unquote, thinking is closely related to consciousness and probably is present in any system where the system can produce behavior and then sense the effects of its behavior on the environment. That's where I don't know if we talked about worm consciousness earlier on here.
That was pre-recorded.
Yeah, that was pre-recorded. Yeah.
Now everyone has to come back for a second
for worm consciousness
to figure out. So I think one way you could frame, you know, the sort of big question of, you know, where does thought come from is evolutionarily, I think thought evolved, I mean, as we experience it as humans, out of the strategy that the neocortex and motor systems use for production of behavior. So you can have a system that just produces a behavior, senses the effect on the environment, and then modifies itself, and then that's it. You have to have the behavior before you see what the outcome
is. This like a chicken and the egg argument? Is like consciousness drives behavior, or does behavior drive consciousness?
Well, I'm gonna get to like higher order systems. So with like motor control with, you know, the human neocortex. So we've got a motor strip in the neocortex that allows us to do really fine-grained movements. It didn't supplant any evolutionarily older motor systems. It just allows us, you know, we can do this like lobster-type movement with our hand with a spinal cord, but, you know, we can play musical instruments with the motor neocortex. And that involves planning. So there's a premotor cortex that has a sequence all put together, and then prior to that, there's, you know, prefrontal cortex where the overall plan is sort of put together. And those same prefrontal areas, they're involved in doing the planning, also model what the likely effect of the behavior on the environment is. So I would say that's a sort of more rudimentary form of thinking, right? It's like, I want to do this behavior. What's likely to happen if I do this behavior? And that's the role of the frontal cortex. So what we call thinking, I think, was built on that sort of very basic strategy of being able to plan motor movements.
Okay.
Right? And sure. So when we're thinking, a lot of it for us, it appears to be verbal behavior.
Yeah.
Which are right. Also, you know, partially frontal cortex circuits. So the fact that we're able to talk and create internal models in the world, I'd say, arose out of this really evolutionarily driven need to be able to do complex motor behaviors and predict what's going to happen when you do that behavior in the future. And then it just got more complicated from there. So your internal dialogue might have, you know, if we could go back billions of years, could have just been, wonder what will happen if I do this, and then that's it.
Right. Right. Here, hold my beer real quick.
Now we can do everything from, like, build ourselves up internally to, you know, talk about how disastrous and catastrophic something that's going on in the world is. And I think that's largely built on the language part. So where the thoughts come from, you know, it's could just be random stimulation from subcortical regions just activating neocortex, and you're trying to make sense out of it. I mean, that's one of the main ideas about dreaming,
right?
Is that you're just trying to make sense out of the world of, like, random patterns that are going on, and that we're just more constrained by when we're awake by the experiences that were happening or used to happen.
Yeah, because I think that way of thinking about it as being an external thing is a really good way to, like, think about it. It's like when your mind's wandering, it's just like you're just kind of planning for anything that could possibly happen. Yeah. Well, I think we're a little over on time, but that's all right, because we'll have either an article or a very short episode next week. We've got the New Mexico State Championships, so we'll do a full recap on that. Derek, thank you so much for coming on the podcast.
Yeah, thank you so much,
Derek.
I appreciate it. Thanks. Is there anything else you want to add?
Yeah, I'd love to come back and do a part two. Grayson and I were talking about lots of fun stuff.
Okay.
So, we look forward to it. Thanks for having me.
All right. Well, that's it, y'all. We hope you appreciate the episode, and we'll get Derek back on. But until next time, live with no regrets.